Okay, so if you're a part of the newsletter, you might have read in the newsletter that email that I send out is Christmas is upon us, right? It's only a couple weeks away. And with that comes the annual onslaught of skeptical objections towards Christmas. And I wanted to share these pictures here. This is, you can see right in the bottom, American Atheists. They're an association. They're nationwide. And these guys, over the last few years, really, they've gotten very vocal and very visual with their attacks on specifically Christianity, right? And so these guys will sue people. These are the ones behind, you know, suing people for prayer in schools, for having the Ten Commandments on the front lawn of, you know, one of these city buildings and stuff like that. So these guys are the ones behind it. And now they've started going to start putting billboards up in key cities, large cities, especially down south in the Bible Belt. And these are a couple of examples we have here. So check out the three wise men. You have the manger, the nativity scene. You know it's a myth. This season, celebrate reason. And that's their big thing. They fundamentally believe that any religion is illusory, delusional. It is nonsensical, basically. Here's the next one. This is the newest one. This is the one this year. And so there's been a lot of hubbub about this. It's a little girl wearing a Santa hat, ironically. It's supposed to be ironic. So she's writing a letter to Santa. Dear Santa, all I want for Christmas is to skip church. I'm too old for fairy tales. So you see the right away the fundamental belief that belief in Jesus is on par with belief in Santa Claus. So they put him in the same category, fairy tale. So you think of even like Peter Pan or the Tooth Fairy, unicorns, they're all in the same category with Jesus, apparently. All right, here's another one. Keep the merry, dump the myth. And if you haven't been here the past couple months, I think it was 2 months ago maybe, we went over showing how the person, the Jesus Christ, was an actual historical person, and he was not based on pagan myths. So if you're interested, if you want to hear that study, just let me know and I can email it to you. So we know that this is just a bold false claim, but this is what they believe, right? And I missed one. Here it is. This is, 1.6 Ohioans. This is in Ohio. No myths when they see them. So they line up kind of a police line up here. You have, was that Neptune? There you go with the trident. Jesus, Santa Claus, and some weird looking devil dude. So American Atheists, these guys, you can see how bold they are in their witnessing to people. Basically, they've said it. They've been in public saying this, that they want atheists to come out of the closet. They're trying to get, because they know that the statistics are very low, like 5%. You know, people are atheists, but they started seeing a steady increase in the past maybe 5-10 years, and I think right now it's started to plateau. So I think they've reached, I don't know what the percentage is, but they're basically trying to get people to come out of the closet and say, hey, I'm atheist, I'm proud of it. And so now you start seeing more atheists in House of Representatives and, you know, in Congress and stuff like that. They're starting to come out of the woodwork, right? So this is what we're dealing with. Every year it's going to happen, and even Easter, that's when you start seeing a lot of books, a lot of articles coming out saying how the resurrection is just a myth, or there's some secret gospel that has some secret knowledge about Jesus, and it's basically trying to show that the resurrection or the birth of Jesus didn't happen, okay? But that's the question on the table. Do we have good reasons to believe, at least in Christmas season, that the birth of Jesus, as told in the gospels, is it an historical fact? All right? Now, of course, I believe we do. Now, hopefully, if you haven't heard any of this evidence, I hope it's persuasive enough for you guys. All right, so if you ever have any questions, just let us know. As a side note, next year, I do want to touch on the origins of Christmas and the traditions that come along with it. So that's 1 year from now. Mark it on your calendars. All right. Now, just to give you a heads up, we're starting to look at the study guide. We're going to be looking at three lines of evidence. Okay. The first line of evidence that we're going to be taking a look at is general reliability of the Gospels. Can we show that, in general, can we first of all show that we can trust the Gospels in what they have to say about Jesus? and specifically the birth of Jesus. And the second line of evidence is archaeological evidence. Right? If these guys claim to be that Jesus is a person that came in at a certain time and point in history, is there any evidence that the world actually shows us that he lived and the places that they mention are real and the people that they mention are real, right? So I'll put general reliability, archaeological. My marker's falling. And then the third one is messianic prophecy. Messianic prophecy. Man. Sorry for my ugly writing. So this is the idea that throughout the Bible, there's been certain beliefs that have arisen out of the scriptures saying, there's somebody coming in the future, the Messiah. And we're, as Christians, we believe that Jesus Christ is that Messiah. He's the one that fulfilled all those prophecies about the coming Messiah. All right, so we're going to touch on that, specifically about his first coming, his birth. Okay, so let's get started right away. Let's look at that first line of evidence, the general reliability of the Gospels. All right, and I want, maybe I'll preface it here. Maybe some of you are in here and, you know, whenever you read your Bible, whenever you come across the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, maybe you take it for granted that, you know, yeah, whatever's in front of me is telling me the truth. Jesus was a real person. The people he interacted with were real. These places were real historical places. And maybe you take it for granted. You've never really thought about it. And you're really, maybe you just look for a kind of key verses where Jesus is talking, obviously, where he gives good moral advice. Maybe that's how you view the gospel so far. You're just looking for good moral advice. Well, over the centuries, you know, a lot of people view that way, right? They have a devotional life, definitely. You want to grow closer to God as you read the Bible. But I think it would be good for us to look at, can we actually see, do we actually have good reasons to know that the Gospels are historically accurate? Because I think that would strengthen that devotional part of our life. If you can actually read now your Gospels and you can say to yourself, wow, this actually is much more, it opens up a whole new world for me. It's actually much more better for me now that I know that I can actually back it up with historical evidence. All right, so that's kind of where we're getting at here. So generally, you know, whenever I talk to people, at least, and I hear arguments about, oh, you can't trust the Gospels or you can't trust the Bible, they fall into three, there's three questions that come up a lot. And so I thought it would be good to kind of address those. Maybe we can have a little discussion about those. And I'd like to know how you would answer them. But there's three questions. Now, it's not my intention tonight to give a full defense of the reliability of the scriptures. We hope to do that next year. Really go in hard and say, okay, these are major pieces of evidence that we know that we can trust the entire Bible. But today, I just want to concentrate on these three questions, and I'll give a little bit of evidence for each of them just to kind of get you started. My aim is for you guys to have conversations this Christmas season, and so you can kind of have a little bit of ammunition in your pocket to at least share with somebody this season. All right? And then we'll dig deeper next year. So let's look at that first question. And it's, how can I trust a book written 2,000 years ago? How many of you guys have heard this one? How can I trust a book written 2,000 years ago? Let me see the hands again. All right. So plenty of us have heard it, right? Let's break down this question. How can I trust a book that was written 2,000 years ago? So let's break down this question. Let's actually see what is the main objection here. How do we break down this question? And this is the way I would break it down. This person is assuming that the more time that passes from the time a book is written, the more time that passes between that book being written and me coming into contact with it, somehow that time makes that book less reliable. So think of your school books that you had in school, right? Think of all the history books, for sure. Does it mean that, you know, I've been out of high school for 10 plus years. Does it mean now when I go back to high school for a 30-year reunion and I look at the books, it's like, I can't trust those books. I can't trust them like I did 30 years ago because 30 years have passed. That's the assumption this person is making, that just because something is way out in the distance and I wasn't there to read it day one, that somehow automatically it's less reliable. Now, how would we respond to something like this? This is that's a good piece of evidence that Ken brought up, the manuscript evidence, and we'll definitely get into that kind of evidence next year. But for the time being, like I said, I like putting the burden of proof on the skeptic. And so I would just like to tell him this. Do you really think that just because time passes, that it automatically makes a document less reliable? I would like to tell him the passing of time is irrelevant. Because consider this. Let's substitute the Bible for any other document or event, right? For instance, the landing of on the moon, or a biography of Abraham Lincoln. So these were happened in the past, right? You could ask him, hey, so we landed on the moon, right? 1969. Does that mean that, let's say 1,000 years from now, you know, whatever civilization exists, and they pick up the history books, and they read about, we landed on the moon on a certain year. Are they automatically going to say, well, that happened 1,000 years ago. I don't think anybody really landed on the moon, right? No. I think the skeptic will probably agree with you. He's like, no. And they'll probably try to come up with like, well, that's not what I'm talking about. No, that it is. That is what you're talking about. What matters is not the time between the writing of the document and me coming in contact with it. What matters, what's relevant is the time of the writing of the document and the events that it purports to write about. That's what really matters. This is how historians do history. Historians generally want the earliest piece of writings or evidence so that they can have good confidence in what these people were writing about. They were actually there. Preferably, they want eyewitness testimony. So think about a police case, a detective. They're looking for eyewitnesses. They don't want secondhand, thirdhand hearsay evidence. They want eyewitness testimony. And so historians, when they look at the Gospels, they're saying, were these guys in the right places and at the right time to be writing this stuff? It doesn't matter how much time passes between me and me reading it and the time it's written. That's irrelevant. What is relevant, I repeat, is the time that these documents were written and the time the events occurred. That's what matters. So yeah, you can challenge the skeptic on this. All right. So that's that first question. How can I trust a book that was written 2,000 years ago? A second claim that comes up a lot is, you know, you talk about Jesus a lot, but I'm not gonna consider anything in the Bible. Show me evidence about Jesus that comes from outside your Bible. Show me evidence outside the Bible that Jesus existed, that Jesus was born, blah, blah, blah. How many of you guys have heard this claim before? Okay. Now let's consider, what is the main objection? What are the underlying assumptions here? How do we break it down? Well, I think that this person, this skeptic, is actually assuming, obviously, that the Gospels themselves somehow cannot be considered as evidence. For some reason or another, they just believe, oh, it's a religious document. That's mainly how they view the Gospels. It's a religious biased document. Therefore, I'm not even going to consider it. How would we respond to this? So that's a good point. There is evidence outside of the Bible. There are historians that wrote about Jesus outside of the Bible, so we do have evidence, so you can definitely point to that. But I think there's an easier route. Again, I like to put the burden of the proof on the skeptic. All right, so consider this response: ask, why do you automatically assume that the Bible can't be used as evidence? Try to figure out where their main objection lies. So ask them, well, how did you come to that conclusion, right? That's my favorite question. How do you know that? Why don't you consider the Bible as evidence? And another thing I like to say is, like, again, don't you know how historians do history? Like, you don't know what you're saying. If you discard the Gospels as evidence, you're actually discarding the best piece of evidence that we have for Jesus. Historians don't care whether it's a religious document or not. Historians view these documents as just historical narratives. And so when they look at the Gospels, they're okay. It's a document, just like anything else. Religious thoughts aside. And so they look, okay, does this provide good evidence? What do I know? How early were these documents written? When it comes to the Gospels, these are actually the earliest pieces of evidence. These, like Ken mentioned, these are eyewitness testimony that we have. And so to that person, I would kind of look at them like, you don't know what you're saying. You actually want to take out the best pieces of evidence that we have for Jesus. Now we do, like I said, we do have evidence outside the Bible, but again, I would challenge that, but you don't know how historians are doing history. They generally, historians consider the Gospels to be the best pieces of evidence. They're eyewitness testimony. So challenge them on that. And also, I would like to show them a few verses and ask them, okay, so maybe you think that the Gospels or the Bible, the New Testament is myth, like these American atheists, right? Somehow you put it on par, on the same category as myth. Well, let me share these few verses with you, and you let me know, does this sound like something, like a mythological tale? All right, and these are the verses that I have written down. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16. This is what Peter wrote. For we did not follow cunningly devised fables when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of his majesty. He's making a claim about reality. I, Peter, was one of the people that were there with Jesus. We didn't listen. I didn't listen about Jesus secondhand. This is not hearsay evidence I'm giving you. I was there. Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. This is great because this is the opening of Luke's gospel. And check out the way he opens up his gospel. You tell me if this sounds like mythological tale. Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who were from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you are instructed. He's writing this letter to a Theophilus, and he's letting him know, many people have undertaken to write about Jesus' life. But I want to write to you, O excellent Theophilus, I want to write to you an orderly account. So he seems to be saying that maybe these accounts that came before his gospel, maybe they were kind of in disarray or something. They weren't in some sort of order. And he wants to put them in order. So he's actually doing, he's interviewing people. He's interviewing the eyewitnesses. He's a journalist at this point. This is not something you find in fairy tale. This is not something you find in myth. All right? And we'll have more to say about Luke and how accurate he was as a historian later. But that's a good one to share. And the last one is 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Now check this. Look for all here for the key words here. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, our hands have handled concerning the word of life, is Jesus. The life was manifested, and we have seen and bear witness and declare to you that eternal life, which was with the Father and was manifested to us, that which we have seen and heard, we declare to you, that you also may have fellowship with us. And truly our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. It doesn't get any more explicit than that. John is saying, we saw him, we touched him, We spent time with him. This wasn't a figment of our imagination. We were eyewitnesses. All right, so these would be good verses, I think, to share with a skeptic and just ask them after you show them, does this sound like myth? Now, I have a feeling that they might say, well, that's your interpretation or something. That's a totally different question. We can handle that at another time. But yeah, these are definitely good verses. All right, that's the second one. The third claim here is about bias. The Gospels were written by biased authors. How do you expect me to trust them when they're biased? How many of you guys have heard this one? The Gospels were biased. I don't listen to that. What's the main objection here? And I think it's obvious. Bias is bad. Right? I think in general, a lot of us, you know, we know how to watch out for bias, right? Especially in the news. You're like, that guy sounds biased. I'm going to take it with a grain of salt here, right? So we know that bias is not something that we want to hold on to, right? But the skeptic's objection here is really that any sort of bias found in any document makes that document automatically unreliable. So if I find even the slightest bit of bias, I can discard the whole thing. He's throwing out the baby with the bathwater, right? How do we respond to this? Well, there's a couple questions I would ask. One, well, do you know of any totally unbiased writings, even including the scientific journals and stuff like that? Do you know of any totally unbiased documents? And this is something that Cliff brought up at UT campus. Some guy brought up this issue about bias. And Cliff, he's like, do you know of any totally unbiased writings? And the skeptic was like, well, no. Well, then what's your argument even about? You know, if there's no unbiased documents, how do you trust anything? You're in school. If your books are not unbiased, how do you even trust your own school books, right? A second question I would want to ask is, do you think it's possible to be completely unbiased? And I think we would all agree is like, no. I mean, whenever we sit down to write, we have an objective in mind. We have a conclusion that we're trying to reach. There's always going to be a little bit of bias in every single thing that we write, all right? So you can ask, and if this person agrees, yeah, it's not possible to be completely unbiased. Again, you ask them, well, why are you even bringing up this argument? And then you can share further that, look, everyone has bias. The challenge, though, is this. Remember, this is how historians do history. They know that they're going to find bias in a document. But the challenge is this for the historian. Can we work our way through or past the bias? And can we actually gather general, reliable information about the past? This is how historians do history. They are trained to kind of sweep away the bias. Okay, what are the facts that are left over? What do I know about the past once I've done away with the biased statements? Okay? And the assumption here is that the Gospels as narratives, that somehow they have to follow the same kind of structure as today's modern writings, like today's modern biographies. So there, it's kind of that's an anachronistic way of thinking. They're trying to impose our modern cultural way of doing things into the past. So they don't understand that in first century, nobody wrote a biography about somebody that didn't matter. Like I wouldn't write a biography about, you know, people in my family who didn't really do much, they just lived their life, if I was in the first century. You only wrote a biography if there was something to learn from that biography. So that's why you had the Caesars and the kings and all that. They had their biographies because these people that wrote them felt that there was something to learn from their lives. All right? So that's just ignorance on their part. All right, so these are the three statements that I kind of hear a lot from time to time, and I think you'll start hearing them more as we get closer and closer to Christmas. So hopefully this will equip you somewhat to at least provide a good response, or at least you don't have to completely tear down their argument, but just put a stone in their shoe. Make them think about, maybe I really haven't thought this issue through. And that'll at least hopefully, if they're intellectually honest, that'll get them started and hopefully they can do some more studying, okay? So let's continue on and let's actually look at a couple more objections. We're still talking about the general reliability of the Gospels. And let's look at a couple more objections, this time dealing with specific passages in the Bible. All right, so we have the birth narratives of Jesus. And remember, they're found in only Matthew and Luke. These were the only two people that wrote about the birth story of Jesus. So we only have to worry about Matthew and Luke today. But you'll see that skeptics, they'll kind of automatically say this phrase. Oh, well, there's a bunch of contradictions in the New Testament. There's a bunch of contradictions in the story of Jesus. And at that point, I would advise you and tell them, whoa, like, let's take a step back. Hold on. Can you actually tell me what a contradiction is? And so that's my question to you here. So we're looking, are there any statements within Matthew and Luke? Did Matthew say something? And then Luke apparently say something that was, well, these statements both can't be true. If that were the case, yeah, we would have a problem on our hands. So that's hopefully the skeptic, they understand that that's what they're talking about. But I would start off by asking them, well, can you define what a contradiction is? And so maybe we're thinking about two different things. I don't know. Let's get on the same page, first of all. So that's a contradiction. And as I asked, are there any statements like that in the Gospels of Luke and Matthew? Well, one of the popular ones that people like to point out is in the genealogies in Matthew and Luke. The genealogies are basically the list of the descendants leading up to Jesus. You can find these in Luke chapter 3, verses 23 through 38. Luke chapter 3, 23 through 38. And then also in the Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 through 17. And I will maybe read just the key pieces that we're concerned with. So the skeptic might actually bring this up. Well, in Matthew chapter 1, verse 16, in the genealogies, it says this: Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus is born, who is called Christ. And the key phrase we're looking at is Jacob, the father of Joseph. This is what Matthew says. But then in Luke chapter 3, Luke wrote this: Jesus began his ministry, was about 30 years of age, being the son, as was supposed, of Joseph, comma, the son of Heli. H-E-L-I. Joseph, the son of Heli. Now, I'm no biologist, but I don't think you can have two fathers, right? Here, apparently, Luke and Matthew seem to have their story, seem to have a contradictory account. Does Joseph have two fathers? Or did one of these guys get it wrong? All right? And also, these two genealogies, if you even read before we get to Jesus, or you read just the differences in the genealogies, you'll see that they actually diverge, and there's completely different names on either side. And so, like, what's the deal here? How do we account for this? That these genealogies are different, but then to top it off, Joseph has two fathers. What's going on here? Well, I'd like to point out an assumption here. If the skeptic brings up this objection, one of the assumptions is that, well, both genealogies are meant to give an ancestry of Joseph, Jesus' adoptive father. So they're saying, well, if he's going through the line of Joseph, then it's impossible that Joseph would have two different fathers. So they're assuming that these genealogies were meant to go through the line of Joseph. Okay? And we'll see. Is that really the case? Now, how would we respond to this? Well, I think as people have investigated this, these are the responses that historians and theologians have come up with. And I think it's plausible, and I think it's a really good answer, is that, well, the genealogy of Luke actually goes through Mary's lineage, not Joseph's. And we'll talk a little bit about how that is in a little bit. So think about it this way. Luke, as I said, he goes through Mary's descendants, Mary's lineage. In Luke chapter 3, in the Greek, right, that's the original language of the New Testament. In the Greek, it does not say the son of Heli. That's something that a lot of English modern translations have inserted. But in the Greek, it doesn't say the son of, it just says the name, Heli. So Joseph, Heli. So that it's just kind of a list of names. But that's how genealogies were written back then. Okay, so it's nothing abnormal or anything like that. But you look at the qualifying phrase that was used. Let me read it again. Luke chapter 3, verse 23. Jesus began his ministry, was about 30 years of age, being the son, as was supposed, of Joseph, the son of Heli, or just Heli, right? That qualifying phrase, as was supposed. That's an interesting little insertion by Luke. Why would he do that? Well, again, you have to take into account is that you always have to ask yourself, who is the audience for these documents? So when Luke wrote his gospel, who was he sending it off to? Not only who was his audience, but what was the purpose for him writing this document? What was his motive? And you also have to ask that about Matthew. Who was his audience, and what was he trying to accomplish when he wrote his gospel? Well, I think it's clear that when you look at Matthew, the reason why he went through Joseph's lineage was that because he was actually writing to a Jewish audience. These were people that were very concerned about lineage going through the father, because the heir of the property or heir of rights and stuff like that went through the father. You look at Joseph, the story of Joseph, or even the prodigal son, right? The people that were heirs were, it was dependent upon the father. The father was the one that gave all his inheritance. And so when we take that into account, when we know that Matthew's audience was Jewish, and that his motive, when you read the entire gospel, you'll see that he's really appealing to Jewish motifs and stuff like that. And it makes sense that his genealogy, and look at the way it starts, Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham.
That's Matthew.
And this makes sense. Why? Because he's writing about the Messiah. The Messiah is like the ultimate Jewish, what you're looking forward to as a Jew. So we wouldn't say that Jesus was the son of David biologically, or the son of Abraham biologically. No, at this moment, he's appealing to his Jewish readers. He's saying, this is the Messiah that I'm writing about. So he's trying to show that Jesus is actually legally should inherit the kingdom. He's the one that's being awaited upon, okay?
And there's two issues. There's one, the legal right to the throne of David.
There you go.
And that descends through the father. But then he also has to be a descendant of David.
Yep.
So therefore it has to descend through the mother. So both are critical.
Yep.
And so he had to show that Joseph is a descendant of David to give Jesus the legal right to the throne, and that biologically he came through David's line because he would be a descendant of David.
Yep. And so that's how you see it in both Gospels. Matthew takes it through Joseph's lineage to establish the legal, and he also establishes the ancestry through David. Both of them do.
And the other issue that comes into play is Athaliah. There was the king's bloodline was cursed. You'll never have a descendant sit on the throne, which, you know, so the descendant came from outside that kingly line at that point, but then the legal right came through Joseph.
Yep.
Because he wasn't a physical descendant of Joseph, but just a...
Right. Right. So yeah, this is how historians and theologians have resolved this matter. They said, well, you don't just look at these genealogies and take them at face value. You have to understand, again, who's the author's audience? What are his motives for writing this? And you'll see, again, it seems that Matthew's trying to establish this legal case, whereas Luke is more going biologically, showing that Jesus basically accomplishes both purposes for owning that kingdom of David, right? As Ken mentioned. Cool. So that's the genealogies portion, okay? That's how we would solve that. Honestly, you know, this skeptic might not come around too often, but at least you'll be ready for it. Okay, so we're looking at apparent contradictions in Matthew and Luke's gospel. And the next one that we see is, it should be on your study guide, that Matthew, apparently, he records that Mary and Joseph are living in a house in Bethlehem when Jesus was born. But then Luke, when you go to his gospel, he says that they were apparently living in Nazareth and traveled to Bethlehem for a census. So it seems they were in two different places whenever Jesus was born. What's the deal here? And for this, I actually want to show a video. I think that the explanation that Tim McGrew gives, he's the one that gave this lecture. And these videos, by the way, he has a series of them. Awesome material. I can give you the links for those. It'd be great in general for reliability of the New Testament. But we're going to look at a little snippet. It's a 5-minute section. And we're going to see how to resolve this. It's kind of a technical, to me at least, these next two. They're kind of technical descriptions, but I think we can follow along. So let's just hear it from Tim McGrew.
Alleged contradiction number 3. Where were Mary and Joseph living?
Do you have it on the fast forward?
Matthew 2 says now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, the days of Herod the king. I just saw that. Matthew 2:11, talking about the coming of the wise men, the Magi, says going into the house they saw the child with Mary his mother. But Luke says Joseph went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem. In other words, it's coming from somewhere else. Is there a contradiction here? Ransacking the internet for people with complaints about the gospel, I ran across this one. Matthew 2, 1 through 12, 22 and 23 says, Joseph was originally a resident of Bethlehem, whereas Luke 1, 26, 27, 56, 2, 4 through 5, and 39 says he was originally a resident of Nazareth. Really? Is that what Matthew says? No. Matthew never says that Joseph and Mary were living in Bethlehem already. The first time Bethlehem is even mentioned is as the place where Jesus is born. But there's been the Annunciation seen to Matthew before that, and there's nothing of this. Matthew doesn't mention a house until the wise men come. When Herod gets upset and sets out to kill the male children, what age limit does he set? 2, which in the Jewish manner of counting would be all of them who haven't passed their first birthday. What does that mean? Because he inquires diligently, Matthew tells us. What time did the star appear? When did you see it? Signaling the birth of the king. We're talking about a period that could be up to a year later here. So there is no assumption that this is the place that they had been all along, or even the place where Jesus was born. It's the place where he is when the wise men come. So period of time later. I understand that at Christmas time it's customary for us to pull out the shepherds and put them right there, right by the little creche in the stable, and then to pull out the wise men and put them at the same place. That's not what the text says. That's an attempt to put the two stories together in a way that they don't license. It makes a pretty panorama for Christmas, but actually those two events are quite distinct. The moral: it is important to read the text for oneself and not take someone else's word for what it says. Just because somebody says, "Oh, Matthew says X," don't assume that it's true. Check it out for yourself. But maybe this answer isn't fully satisfactory. Here's a complaint about it. If Mary and Joseph were living somewhere other than Bethlehem before Jesus was born, why didn't Matthew say so? Do you see the assumption that lies behind this? None of the Gospels professes to give the complete account of the life of Jesus. That assumption of completeness, that every record has to give us every detail about everything, is bogus. And we know this. The more historical research we do, the more clear this is to us. That wasn't their purpose. Note what John expressly says, John 20, verse 30. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. And the signs Jesus did are a lot more important to the authors of the Gospels than the details of his birth. 2 of them give us some of those details. But even of the things that are very important that Jesus did, they're not written. Notice the assumption here, the complaint, it arises from a misplaced expectation of completeness.
Okay. Did that make sense to everyone? Showing, basically, it's faulty assumptions on the skeptic's part. Again, they're not really taking the time to do some serious Bible study. When you do Bible study, you have to put yourself in the first century perspective. You have to understand how these people would have written their biographies. And there's a lot of hidden assumptions when the skeptic comes along with these objections. And that's why I always say my favorite question to ask him is, well, how do you know that? How did you come to that conclusion that this is a contradiction? What assumptions are you making? What's your explanation? You tell me. Put the burden of proof on them. Okay? So if there's no questions about that one, we can continue on to the next one. And this is probably the biggest claim. And I'm going to show another video for this one. It's about twice as long, but this one's even a little bit more technical. But again, like I said, I'd rather let Tim McGrew handle it because he's much better explaining it, the nuances. And like I said, it's probably the most popular objection that you hear about these contradictions, especially about the birth narrative of Jesus. And the claim, as you see on your study guide, it says, Matthew claims that Jesus was born during the reign of Herod the Great, but Luke claims that Jesus was born during the census of Quirinius more than a decade later. So it was either Jesus was born twice or one of these gospel writers got it wrong, right? What's the deal? So let me fire it up here. Go to the next one.
Yeah. Objection number two picks right up on this. And this is the one that most people think is the killer. Luke says, this was, or at least this is how our translations read. I'm quoting from the English Standard Version, the ESV here. Translations vary. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria. I'm not using the NIV. One of the reasons I don't like to use the NIV, although it's a very readable translation and people love it for that reason, they tend to add words that aren't there in the original. It's an interpretive translation, so what you're getting isn't just a translation of the words. It's an attempt to tell you what the translators think was meant in a fuller sense. For example, in the previous verse, the NIV inserts the word Roman. The whole world, the whole Roman world. The word Roman isn't there in any text whatsoever. They think they're doing you a favor by supplying it. It's just not there. And of course, in this case, I think that gives an actual misimpression of what's going on. But in verse 2, here, the way the ESV translates it, sounds like it's saying all of this stuff happened, this decree happened when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Here's the problem. Quirinius didn't become governor of Syria until the year 6 AD. This is 10 years after Herod the Great was dead. He died in 4 BC. So how can a chronological blunder of 10 or 12 years just be explained? This looks like a mistake. Now, let's stop and let's just look at this coldly from the point of view of an historian. Forget that you're dealing with a text that has been held to be sacred. Set aside anything about inspiration. Suppose for the sake of the argument that Luke goofed. Suppose for the sake of the argument that he got his wires crossed and associated the birth of Jesus with something that happened 10 to 12 years later. That would not mean that he's totally incompetent with respect to everything else. It would just mean that in this one case, he had made an error. If he gets a lot of other things right, you might still say, eh, he could still be a decent historian, so he made a mistake here. So this one wouldn't kill it, but it is a bit of an embarrassment. Let's see what can be said about it. Before we answer it, we need to take a look at two other things about Luke. First of all, Luke knows Jesus was born during the reign of Herod the Great. He starts out right after his prologue in his gospel talking about this. He's talking about the birth of John, who was, of course, born just months before Jesus was born. So he knows that this is all taking place in the reign of Herod the Great. Second, he knows about the taxation under Quirinius because he quotes something from Gamaliel in Acts 5. that shows Gamaliel's awareness of it, and he's clearly referring there to the census under Quirinius. So any explanation we give for what is going on in Luke 2:2 has got to come to terms with these two facts about what Luke already knows. Any explanation that flies in the face of that doesn't fly. There are two possible answers. I will tell you which one I think is right, but many good scholars think the other one is right, and this is one of those cases where, speaking as historians, we cannot be absolutely certain. So I'm going to give them both to you. Answer number one, Quirinius may have had two periods as a governor of some sort in Syria. If so, Luke could be referring to the earlier period. That is possible. We'll discuss that in a minute. Second explanation, the Greek in this text does not actually claim that the well-known taxation under Quirinius took place in 6 BC. We'll look at that one after we're done with the first one. So first, to the first possible answer. We know that there was a fellow named Quintilius Varus, who was the governor of Syria from about 6 to 4 BC. Before him, and right before him, a fellow named Saturninus was governor. So if Quirinius was governor in Syria at the time when Jesus was born, then he was not the only governor. He was there as some kind of extraordinary legate of Caesar. And Caesar did send people out in that extraordinary capacity. With respect to Saturninus, there was a fellow named Volumnius, whom Josephus calls governor. He speaks of the two of them in the same sentence as governors of Syria, even though only one of them was the Senate-appointed governor. So the term governor could be stretched. We'll come back to the flexibility of that term as we look at a later objection. So it is possible that Quirinius was a governor on special mission from Caesar at that time and in that area. It would have fit with the need to keep an eye on Varus. Varus was notoriously cruel and incompetent. More than a decade later, he was the military leader responsible for losing the Roman legions in the Battle of Teutoburg Forest, causing Caesar Augustus to cry out, "Varus, where are my legions?" Augustus may already have had worries about him, and if he had, it wouldn't have been out of character for him to send a trusted man of military worth, which Quirinius already was, to keep an eye on things there personally for him. So that's possible. There's an inscription that was found at Tivoli describing somebody, we don't know who because the beginning is broken off, who, being a legate of Augustus for the second time, received Syria and Phoenicia. That might have been a reference to Quirinius, and if it were, that might indicate that he had been an imperial legate sometime in the BCs, earlier than AD 6. But the grammar of the inscription, if you took it strictly, indicates that this person's second time is his second time as an imperial legate, not his second time as the governor of Syria. So grammatically, it's not as helpful as it might have seemed. This explanation remains possible, but it doesn't have any direct support. The inscription's just not clear enough to give us a firm grip on it. So that explanation remains possible, not as well supported as some people have claimed that it is. But let's look at the Greek a little bit more closely. There's a word in the Greek that can be read one of two ways. And since the earliest manuscripts were all done in capital letters, the two would look the same. One would be haute, this, and one would be aute, which is a reflexive. That would mean itself. Now, quite a number of scholars think that we should read it that way. In our lowercase manuscripts, where the accent marks and breathing marks had been written in later, the people who transcribed those chose to render it one way, but it had to be a guess from the uncial manuscripts, the capital letter manuscripts. In your handout, I've shown you how it would look. It would be the identical set of four Greek capital letters for either word. If we read it that way, then here's how it would read. The apographe itself, and we'll come back to what that apographe means. was first made, etc. Now, the term apographe is a really interesting word. It means not a taxing necessarily, it could mean that, but a registration, an enrollment, a signing up. The graphe part is where we get autograph also, right, your signature. So the apographe means, in the first instance, a registration. And then, more generally, it can mean a taxation involving a registration. So there's a kind of metonymy going on, the part for the whole. The part is the signing up, sign up, register, and then the whole thing comes to be known by the same word. So an admissible reading of Luke's Greek here is that Quirinius picked up where the matter was dropped in 6 BC when Herod got back into Caesar's good graces and brought the taxation itself to pass. That would require that Luke use a certain verb a certain way, and it turns out that he does. He uses the verb agenata this way in Acts 11:28, where there's been a prophecy of the famine, and then he says, and this came to pass during the reign of Claudius. He uses the same verb there that he uses here, which is being rendered, was first made in this translation. Now, what are the consequences of this reading? First of all, Luke's passing mention of the apographe in the time of Judas the Galilean in Acts 5:37 doesn't have to be explained away. He knew that that one was the one under Quirinius. No problems. Second, his brief reference to the registration fits together with what Josephus says about an oath of allegiance to Caesar. So that dovetails with what Josephus says. We could wish for more, but what we have fits together. Third, there's no need to predate the governorship of Quirinius to 6 BC. So all of the apparent chronological discrepancies disappear. So we have two possible responses to objection number two. It may be that Quirinius had an official role in Syria, both around 6 BC and around AD 6. More probably, though, in my estimation, Luke intends to convey that although the census was aborted in 6 BC, it was picked up and carried through to its logical completion, the taxation itself, under Quirinius in AD 6.
All right. And that was really tough, right? Going into the Greek, and that's crazy.
I don't know why you didn't want to discuss
Yeah. Yep. Are there any questions about that before we move along? Did it make sense, or was it just a lot of information? I think so, right? I will say this, though. Again, I can give you the link, and you can kind of listen to it over and over, try to make sense of it. But I do want to say this to close off the general reliability portion. When it comes to contradictions in the Bible in general, remember, you first have to settle with the skeptic. What is the definition of a contradiction? Okay? And secondly, as Christians, like Tim McGrew said, you know, as Christians, we believe in the inspiration of Scripture and the inerrancy of Scripture. That whatever the Scripture speaks about it correctly, factually, and historically. And so there's no error, and it has authority for the Christian's life, right? When we come across hard sayings like this, hard passages where there's apparent contradictions, because we believe that Jesus Christ has risen from the dead and he is Lord of all, we take his word and we say, you know what? I might not know the answer, but I trust that there is an answer. I trust that it is right because God has shown himself to be trustworthy in other areas, namely the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So we have a theological response, as it were, to why we can trust these scriptures. But as Tim McGrew is mentioning, in order to answer a contradiction, the minimal amount that I have to show to the skeptic is that it is not contradictory. I don't necessarily have to have a complete answer for the skeptic, something certain. All I have to give the skeptic is a possibility. Hey, this is a possible answer. And just because it's possible, it means by default that there is no contradiction. You know what I'm saying? So you don't have to have a certain answer for them. You just show it's a possibility. It's plausible to me. But at the very least, you cannot say, Mr. Skeptic, that this is a contradiction any longer. So that's what I want to say about that. Okay? So that closes the general reliability of the scriptures. So we went through some of the key questions, and then we tackled three of the most popular apparent contradictions. So I hope that helps out. And of course, if you have any more questions, you know, talk to me and we can try to find an answer after. But let's move on to the archaeological and then the messianic prophecy. Right? These are probably, this is going to go a lot quicker, so be happy for that. All right, let's start with the archaeological. So we already showed that the writers of the New Testament did not write myth. As a result, in the Gospels, we see the writers mentioning specific places and people in order to give context for their writings, right? Like we saw Luke, like Tim McGrew is mentioning, when Luke opens up his Gospel, he says that Jesus was born during the reign of Herod the Great, and he mentions a bunch of names and their titles and places. So he's setting himself up for failure if he's writing myth, right? But the question is, he wrote all these things. Do we actually have archaeological evidence to show that what these writers wrote about, the people they wrote about, the titles they assigned to these people, and the places, do we actually have archaeological evidence to show that these places existed, that these people existed, and that those were the titles? All right, this is big. This is kind of like the big one. Now, if the skeptic is not convinced with this, I mean, because the skeptics are always more than likely going to say, I have to see it for myself. All right, if you want something to put your eyes on and touch and feel, let's look at the archaeological evidence. What does that point to? And when it comes to Luke, remember, we're talking about the birth story of Jesus. When it comes to Luke specifically, it was once thought, I'm quoting now, it was once thought that Luke had concocted his narrative from the ramblings of his imagination because he ascribed odd titles to authorities and mentioned governors that no one knew. All right? The question on the table is, was Luke a good historian or not? Was Luke a good historian or not? Another quote, it says, if an ancient historian's incidental details check out to be accurate time and time, or time after time, this increases our confidence in other material that the historian wrote, but that cannot be as readily cross-checked. So, like Tim McGrew is saying, he says, if Luke might have gotten like one thing wrong, but he got like 99 things right, we would still consider Luke a good historian. But of course, we're Christians. We believe that Luke got it all right. You know, all truth is God's truth, and we believe that Luke was inspired when he wrote his gospel, and that we are sure to find many pieces of evidence where Luke checks out. Another quote from this book, this was, John McCrae, he's the archaeologist in the book. He says this, oh, there's no question that the credibility of the New Testament is enhanced just as the credibility of any ancient document is enhanced when you excavate and find that the author was accurate in talking about a particular place or event. That's from an archaeologist. He's saying, yeah, if we find something that they talked about, it increases their credibility. Well, let's check out Luke's accuracy as a historian. In Luke chapter 3, verse 1, Luke writes this, now, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being a governor of Judea, Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip tetrarch of Iturea and the region of Trachonitis, and Lysanias tetrarch of Abilene. And that key phrase that I want to concentrate on is the last one, is Lysanias tetrarch of Abilene. Now, up to a very, recent in terms of history, nobody really thought that Luke was speaking truthfully here because nobody found any evidence that there was a Lysanias being a tetrarch of Abilene. In all the archaeological finds, we couldn't find evidence about this. Let me see if I have the reference here. Oh, I don't have the year that they found it. I'm trying to remember. Probably won't. But I will say this, an archaeological find, an inscription was found, which actually names Lysanias as tetrarch, dated between 14 and 29 AD. And it actually matches up with all the other titles that Luke gave beforehand. 14 and 29 AD. And this is the way it pans out. You see, the inscription read this, for the salvation of the august lords and all of all their household, Nymphaeus, freedman of Eagle Lysanias, tetrarch, established this street and other things. They're kind of dedicating these streets to Lysanias. But the opening phrase, he says, the salvation of the august lords. The august lords was a specific title. It was a joint title given only to Emperor Tiberius, who was the son of Augustus, and his mother Livia, who was the widow of Augustus. So that august lords title, that was a specific title given to those specific people, those two people, Tiberius and his mother Livia. This reference establishes the date of the inscription to between 14 and 29 AD, because the year 14 was the year of Tiberius's accession, and the year 29 was the year of Livia's death. So if somebody's referencing both of them together, the assumption is that they're both alive. And so we can actually start, okay, when did Tiberius take over? When did Livia die? This is the actual time period which we can date this inscription. And so point number one for Luke, people doubted him. There's no Lysanias, there's no tetrarch, there's no evidence of this, therefore it must be wrong. Lo and behold, we find archaeological evidence here. Well, let's continue on with Luke. He also wrote the book of Acts, right? In Acts chapter 17, verse 6, we find this, that Luke wrote, "But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, 'These who have turned, the world upside down have come here too.'" And the key phrase that I want to concentrate on here is rulers of the city. In the Greek, the word being used here is polytarchus. Polytarchs. Kind of a transliteration there. So a reference is made to this title of the rulers of the city, and they're called polytarchs. And no evidence of the term had been found in any ancient Roman documents. And so this was... Everybody was doubting Luke. Luke got it wrong on this example here. There's no mention ever of any in any documents of the title polytarchs. What's going on, Luke? Well, in 1835, 1800 years later, right, a Greek inscription was discovered on an arch at Thessalonica, in the very city that Luke was purporting to write about, which contained the title polytarch. In Greek, polytarchus, right? And so there we have it again. Luke scores again. And this is just a second example that I'm giving you because I think that's all we have time for. But I just want to give you kind of a flow. Luke, a lot of people really concentrate on Luke because Luke was very detailed in his reporting, in his Gospels, and in the book of Acts. He was very detailed. And so that's why people put him to the test. Is Luke really giving us... the facts. Well, it's interesting to note that many historians have really tried to kind of give it to Luke. They've really tried to pin him down and prove him wrong. But time and time again, Luke comes up scoring points here. And his credibility just keeps going up and up and up. In fact, these are some quotes that I want to read to you. And I think you have them in your study guide, at least most of them. But here's some. "The general consensus of both liberal and conservative scholars is that Luke is very accurate as a historian. Archaeological discoveries are showing over and over that Luke is accurate in what he has to say." Another quote would be, "Archaeology has not produced anything that is unequivocally a contradiction to the Bible. On the contrary, as we've seen, there have been many opinions of skeptical scholars that have become codified into fact over the years, but that archaeology has shown to be wrong." So you have these critical scholars, archaeologists, that are saying, "Ah, Luke got it wrong, and I'm going to go prove him wrong." But lo and behold, when they do the digs, they find Luke to be right. All in all, Luke names 32 countries, 54 cities, and 9 islands without making a single error. So this actually gives credibility to show that Luke was actually interviewing the right people, but that he was also, in the book of Acts for sure, he was an eyewitness to a lot of these events. So he was very careful to detail these cities, the names of people, and the names of the titles and stuff like that. Luke's getting it right. His credibility is off the charts. Now, another archaeological problem is the existence of Nazareth. The existence of Nazareth. Now, apparently, Nazareth, not mentioned in the Old Testament, not mentioned by Paul, not mentioned in Jewish, ancient Jewish writings, or even by Josephus, who wrote kind of like a long diatribe about the history of the Jews, right? In fact, no ancient historians or geographers mentioned Nazareth before the beginning of the 4th century. And so Luke here, he mentions Nazareth, and you're like, did he just make a place up? You know, is he blowing smoke? Well, interestingly enough, in 1962, this is very recent according to history, right? Archaeologists found a list in Aramaic describing the 24 families of priests who were relocated. And one of them was registered as having been moved to Nazareth. So there's kind of like a writing, an inscription on a wall. And it was a list of these priests who were relocated. Why were they relocated? Well, remember, Jerusalem was thrashed. It was destroyed in 70 AD. All right, there was an uprising. Now, that's where the temple was. Now, the Jews had no temple to go and offer their sacrifices. So the priests had no job. They had to be relocated at this time. And so they were sent off to these various locations, even up to into Galilee. And now you find this inscription that actually shows that one of these priests was relocated to Nazareth. So that shows that this tiny village must have been there during that time. This is in the second century, maybe like around 130 AD. So even up to 130 AD, after the Jesus lived and the apostles all lived and died, Nazareth was still in existence at that time. And this is what the archaeologist in the book Case for Christmas says. There has been discussion about the location of some sites from the first century, such as exactly where Jesus' tomb is situated. But among archaeologists, there has never really been a big doubt about the location of Nazareth. So after this, there's actually been more digs, and they've actually kind of found the perimeters of this little tiny town of Nazareth. About 500 people lived here. Okay? And so they found the perimeters because they started finding burial sites. And in a Jewish culture, you buried your dead outside the walls of the city. And so they found these kind of grave sites, and they were able to establish at least a perimeter of this tiny town. So again, as time is passing, archaeologists are doing more digging, and they're using the Bible as reference. Okay, did he get it right? Time and time again, it's coming up as true. So this is awesome testimony to Luke's accuracy as a historian. One last archaeological example is, there's a mention of the slaughter. Remember Herod, and he issues this slaughter of the everyone under 2 years old, right, in Bethlehem. Well, the problem is that, again, there's no independent confirmation aside from Luke, this testimony, that there was a mass murder that ever took place. There's nothing about it in the writings of Josephus, who gave the fullest kind of historical perspective of the Jews, or any other historian. No archaeological support. There are no records or documents. So, does a Christian have a problem on their hand? What's going on here? Here's the way the objection is written. Certainly, an event of this magnitude would have been noticed by someone other than Matthew, right? I mean, think about today. Genocide, somebody's killing a bunch of people. We see Boko Haram down in Africa. We see a bunch of slaughter happening all across the world. We get it in an instant. Certainly a slaughter like this would have been traveling just as fast, right? Well, hold on. With the complete absence of any historical or archaeological corroboration, isn't it logical to conclude that this slaughter never occurred? Right? That's what the skeptic's trying to show. Actually, Luke is just coming up with some sort of grand story to try to push his agenda. Well, remember, we have to put ourselves back. We have to put our first century sandals on, as it were. We got to put ourselves in their perspective, okay? Bethlehem was probably no bigger than Nazareth, right? They were similar sized cities, so around a population of between 500 and 600. Now, think about that. In a population of about 500 or 600 total people, how many babies of that age, 2 and under, would there be in a village of 500 or 600? Not that many, right? Now, of course, you're probably saying, well, it's still a slaughter. If Herod issued it, there must be some sort of record about it. Well, not so fast. Because when you look into the history of who Herod was and how he operated, we get this. Herod the Great was a bloodthirsty king. This guy was paranoid. And he was very quick to issue murder, basically 187s on a bunch of people. He's like, I don't like this guy. I'm scared of this guy. Kill him. Off with his head, right? In fact, he killed members of his own family, his own sons, his one of his wives, because he was paranoid about just his sons taking over, who was going to take over. He was really power thirsty, and he was bloodthirsty as a result. So this was just the name of the game for Herod. So when he issues this, oh, go kill all the infants, 2 years and under, in Bethlehem, it might have been one of several of these issues that he might have mandated. This is just business as usual for Herod. So it really wouldn't surprise us that this didn't make it into the records. One, because Bethlehem's so small. But two, this is just who Herod was. So this probably wasn't a significant event for Josephus to write down. But for Luke, obviously, remember, he's writing a biography with a purpose. It's important for him to include this because he's showing, you know, somehow how Jesus survived this slaughter, or avoided it, rather. And so it's particularly interesting to him, okay? So I think that's how we can, even though we don't have archaeological evidence, I think we have just a good, solid explanation for why this is. It's plausible, okay? Again, tell the skeptic, you got to look at this account in your first century sandals, okay? Put yourself in the perspective. So that covers the archaeological evidence, okay? That's just a brief snippet, a brief introduction. And there's many more, and I'll talk more about that later on. But let's move on to the last piece, which is the messianic prophecies. Messianic prophecies. Again, I mentioned in the beginning is that in the Old Testament, you have various passages and verses throughout the prophets, throughout the writings of Moses, that speak, even the poetic, like Psalms, you have these passages that seem to be pointing towards the coming of the Messiah. All right, these are centuries before Jesus ever stepped on the scene. And personally, I think that prophecy is a great witnessing tool. You can show, look, of course there have been many purported people who say they can predict the future. Now, what's the percentage of being correct? Right, you look at Nostradamus. I think some study has been on, even though Nostradamus is so vague, you know, you can interpret it any which way. If you kind of take it at face value, and you kind of say, "Oh, this might be referencing this event or whatever." It turns out that Nostradamus is on average accurate about 40% of the time. So you know what? He probably doesn't have any better idea than you or I. I mean, I think both you and I could average about that. You know. So yeah, there's been plenty of people who have tried to predict the future. How many of them really got it right? Now remember, in the Old Testament, there was a way to test out prophets. If what they said was going to happen did not happen, God said, don't be afraid of that prophet. In fact, kill that prophet. He's a false prophet. All right. So in order to be an accurate predictor of the future, you had to be 100% correct, according to the Old Testament, right? And so you have these predictions laid out throughout the Old Testament pointing towards this Messiah figure. Okay, and so because of this kind of high expectation for these predictions in the Old Testament, I think it's a great witnessing tool to show, hey, well, let me show you some verses here, and you tell me who you think they're talking about. All right? Now, let's see if Jesus is actually the person who fulfilled these prophecies, right? And so you can compare Old Testament versus Jesus' life in the Gospels, okay? And so I listed some verses there that you can take a look at, and they deal specifically with the coming of the Messiah, right? And there's all sorts of other predictions that deal with the death of the Messiah, the second coming of the Messiah, stuff like that. But right now we're just concentrated on the Christmas season, right? So we're concentrated on the first coming of the Messiah. And I'll read, what are these? Maybe I'll read some. Galatians 4:4. Just want to read a couple to you. Paul wrote, but when the appropriate time had come, God sent out his son, born of a woman, born under the law. All right, when the appropriate time had come. So it seems Paul's actually referencing in the Old Testament, there was an expectation of this Messiah and that Jesus came at the appropriate time to fulfill those prophecies about the Messiah. And then also going to the Old Testament. So you see under the reference to 1 Corinthians 15, there's Isaiah 53, and that's where it begins the Old Testament references. Isaiah 53, very popular one. I encourage you guys to kind of memorize some of these Old Testament ones, and you can use them in conversations. Starting in verse 2, he sprouted up like a twig before God, like a root out of parched soil. He had no stately form or majesty that might catch our attention, no special appearance that we should want to follow him. And then it actually goes to describe the suffering servant. But this particular passage here, verses 2 and 3, or verse 2 rather, it says that he didn't come in this grand gesture. And look at Jesus' birth. He had a very humble entrance into the world. Just having a normal birth, right? So that's Isaiah 53. Isaiah 7, verse 14, I believe, speaks about the virgin birth. Right? So now that's talking about a virgin shall birth a son. I forget the exact reference, but it speaks about a virgin. And then you go and look at Matthew and Luke's account and how the angel spoke to Mary saying, look, you're going to birth a son. And she's like, I've never known a man, right? So that was a virgin birth. So we can see that explicit fulfillment there. Micah chapter 5, verse 2 speaks about the birthplace of Jesus. Birthplace. So out of Bethlehem. That's a specific reference to Bethlehem, where the Messiah was going to come out of. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, saying it's going to come from the seed of a woman. He's telling the serpent there in the garden. So that's the kind of very early reference to the Messiah. It's going to come from the seed of a woman. So that's entrance into the world there. Jeremiah 23, verse 5, speaks about Jesus' ancestry. I forget the exact wording there, but it speaks about Jesus' ancestry. So you can look at that one. But now we take a look at, okay, three questions about fulfilling this prophecy. The coincidence theory, the fabrication theory, and then the intentional. And the coincidental says, could Jesus have coincidentally fulfilled these prophecies? So this is a skeptic saying, oh, well, it's not really a big deal that he fulfilled these prophecies, right? Anybody really could have done that. It's just coincidence that he did, and now you want to apply this title of Messiah and God to Jesus. Well, not so fast. Let's look at this. There's a gentleman named Peter Stoner, I believe, and he did the math. And he collected all these prophecy statements in the Bible about Jesus, about the Messiah. And he discovered, what is the probability of fulfilling, let's say, just 8 of these prophecies? Right? So he did the math on this. A probability of just fulfilling 8 of them is 1 in 100 million billion. So I believe that's 3, 6, 9, yep, 17 zeros. There you go. 1 in 10 to the 17. It's a popular one, yeah. So 1 in 10 to the 17, guys, that's astronomical. That's a ridiculous probability, right? Think about how we even look at the lotto and stuff like that. I'll never win the lotto. The lotto has much greater probability than this, okay? So,
and that's just 8.
Yeah, that's just 8 of them. Now, he even took it, okay, what's the probability of fulfilling 48 of these prophecies? Now, mind you, we're talking about prophecies that deal not just with the coming of the Messiah, but every prophecy, right? These are just 48, and there's over 300 that we can look at. But even if... How would you fulfill 48? What's the probability there? It jumps up tremendously. 1 in 10 to the 117th power. All right, now you have to tell a skeptic, look, Like, at what point are you going to cut this off? What point are you going to say, look, this is not really probable? You have to come to terms with the facts. You're a skeptic. All right? These are crazy statistics. Now, you're saying Jesus coincidentally fulfilled these prophecies? I don't think so. Now, what about the fabrication theory? Is it possible that the gospel writers deliberately fabricated details to make it appear that Jesus fulfilled the prophecies? So again, they're saying that the gospel writers are liars, all right? That these guys just had an agenda and they just made up a story about Jesus. Well, it's not likely. Remember, at the time that the gospels were written, they were written when people on both sides were still alive. So people who were eyewitnesses to Jesus' life and they spent time with him, these people were still alive, so they could have corroborated any mistakes that the gospel writers may have made in their stories. Say, oh, that actually didn't happen. That wasn't a prophecy that was fulfilled by Jesus. They were around at the time. But not only that, you have people on the other side. You had enemies of Christianity that were alive who could have said, oh, actually, Jesus didn't die this way, or he wasn't buried here. He wasn't born here, stuff like that. So it doesn't make sense that they would have fabricated stuff because they had people who were readily available to correct them if they needed correcting. Not only that, but the popular response that Christians can give is, why would the apostles be willing to die for something they know is a lie? Nobody does that. When you're pushed and you're like, how about you confess and say this is a lie, or you reject Jesus or I'll kill you. Now, if you know it's a lie, it's like, no, okay, I was just kidding. I was just trying to make some money. I was just trying to get some power or whatever. Let me live. Why would you be willing to die? It doesn't make sense. Okay, how about the intentional theory? This is the last one. How could Jesus have intentionally set out himself to fulfill these prophecies? Well, I think here the skeptic is showing his ignorance about certain prophecies about the Messiah. Namely, well, you can say, yeah, for a few, Jesus could have. Like when he rode in on a colt into Jerusalem, yeah, he could have done certain things, right? But Jesus had no control over where he was born, the birthplace. He had no control in the manner in which he was born by a virgin. He had no control over the manner of his death. He didn't know that this was ultimately going to lead he couldn't have controlled that he would lead to a crucifixion, so the manner of his death, or the place of his burial, or the fact that he was going to be crucified in between two thieves, as was prophesied, or that Judas was going to offer 30 pieces of silver, right? And definitely even the time of his birth. There's a prophecy in Daniel chapter 9 that actually gives us the time frame in which Jesus would be born. Jesus can't control these things. So yeah, skeptic, for a few maybe, but consider these other prophecies. Jesus can't have control of these. So it doesn't make sense that Jesus would intentionally, I think I'll be the Messiah. Okay, let me go. Okay, I got to do this. Today I'll do that. Tomorrow I'll do this one. No, there are certain things he has no control over. So I think overall, the messianic prophecy is really a good witnessing tool to show the skeptic, hey, look, we're dealing with prophecies that were written thousands of years before, and like Ken mentioned, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, and one of the complete scrolls that we have is the scroll of Isaiah. And Isaiah was written 700 years before Jesus. And when you read Isaiah chapter 53, there's no question that that's talking about Jesus. There's no question. And so I think that would be a good opportunity for you to show a skeptic, hey, what do you have to say about this? This was clearly written well before, and we have good evidence to show that we can trust what the gospel writers are saying. How do you reconcile that? What evidence do you have, Mr. Skeptic? All right. So that's the end of the study. But I will mention this at the end is I want you just to take a step back and look at the different lines of evidence that we used again. Right. And I want you to consider this, that we actually just got a good introduction into what can be separate classes on their own. And they will be. We'll eventually go through full studies about the general reliability of the New Testament and the Gospels, archaeological evidence, and messianic prophecy. So you got a really good introduction tonight. Just enough for you guys to have good conversations with skeptics, for this Christmas season. And I pray, and I hope you guys pray for those conversations to happen. And hopefully you can share some of this information. But get excited, because there's much more evidence to consider. And we'll be considering that over the next year.